Welcome to Dispelling the Myth. This is your host, Kalia LaRoche, Minister of the Spirit, where it is my divine purpose in life to help others to find their way from the darkness to the light, where you remember the truth of who you are and why you are here. I want to thank you all for taking the time to listen today, whether you're here with us now for the live show or listening at a later time. If you're joining us live and feel inspired to ask a question later in the show, we'll be accepting calls. Just call in to 347-826-9626. That is 347-826-9626. Our topic tonight is psychic vampires. I first came across this term when I was living in Sedona, Arizona, where I had a boyfriend who always seemed to be energetically tied to me in a very unhealthy way. In fact, I was at an event, and a woman who was able to see psychic energy could see a cord going from me to this boyfriend, and she reported seeing him sucking energy from me, which was a term I wasn't familiar with at the time. Later, during that same time frame, I was having a healing session. And this is a typical Sedona thing. This happens a lot in Sedona, where the healer was cutting the psychic energy cords attached to my energy field. And my boyfriend, who was in the next room waiting for me, suddenly got up and barged into the room very suddenly, and he was really disoriented and upset. The next day, I received three emails. One was from an ex-boyfriend, one from his ex-wife, and another from his daughter, all whom I hadn't heard from for probably 2 years, and all had felt on some level the severance of this psychic connection and were reaching out to reconnect with me. So psychic energy is a very real thing, and we don't understand it if we don't understand it and learn to protect ourselves from the negative and dark energies that come our way. We can find ourselves very much out of balance and drained. Tonight, we have a very special guest with us, Barbara Hort, who has written a book called Unholy Hungers, Encountering the Psychic Vampire in Ourselves and Others. In her fascinating study of this dark psychological archetype, Barbara Hort looks to traditional myths as well as their modern equivalents in literature, theater, and film. She offers insight into how psychic vampires originate, how we allow ourselves to be caught in their clutches, and how we can protect ourselves from their seductive influence. Barbara has been in Jungian practice in Portland, Oregon for 20 years. She is the co-creator of Theater of the Soul, a workshop based on Barbara's apprenticeship with Marianne Woodman. Welcome, Barbara.
Thank you very much, Kalia.
How are you doing today? Are you having a good night?
I'm having a good night.
Good.
Pleasure and honor to be here. Thank you.
Well, it's great to have you. And I'm really looking forward to getting your insight into psychic psychic vampirism. Could you tell me how you would describe a psychic vampire from your perspective?
Well, first let me say that the term vampire is a metaphorical one. There are people who've asked me if I believe in real vampires and people who literally suck the blood of other people. And my answer is always that I have no idea. People do a lot of odd things, and anything is possible. This is a very complicated world, and I certainly don't know most of that about it. But in my treatment of this, the term vampire is a metaphor. And as a Jungian, my understanding is that metaphors and myths are the ways that human beings have always used to describe things that were too complex or subtle or mysterious to be described in concrete terms. And so we as a species develop various kinds of stories to describe our experiences so that we not only understand what's happening, but have choices about how to make something different happen. So in a more concrete sense, one could say that the psychic vampire is a quality of energy that lives probably in all of us, because the vampire myth is very ancient. It predates history. 5,000 years ago, the Babylonians talked about a monster called an Akimu that drank the blood in order to keep itself going, drank the blood of others. And the vampire is a myth that's found in every culture of the world. So from a Jungian point of view, this means that this is an experience that is pretty much universal for human beings. From my point of view, what I think this means is that it is the energy that is potential in all of us, but more active in some of us than others, more active in some situations than in others. And essentially what has happened when the energy that we might call, if we just put this label on it, that we would call the psychic vampire, wakes up and becomes active in us is usually when we have been, you know, like there's a wonderful Jungian analyst named Jean Shinoda Bolen who wrote in a book called The Ring of Power, I am convinced that we come into the world seeking love, and when we do not find love, we settle for power. And I think that the psychic vampire is the energy that wakes up in us whenever we are in danger of lovelessness, some usually early in our lives, although not always, and so we settle for power. If we can't get love, we go for power, power over someone else. It is a surrogate, imitation of love. And we begin to have relationships of power with people which are much more about taking than giving, and they are not very generative relationships. So from the vampire myth, this would mean that we can't generate our own blood, so we need to feed on the blood, the life force, the love of somebody else, because something has gone wrong, there's some disconnect, and we don't know how to generate that within ourselves, because at some point there was no love, no loving to teach us how to do that. And so with certain kinds of people or in certain circumstances, we start using power instead of love, and it feels to others as if we are pulling their power, their love, their energy out of them and taking it for ourselves. But we have to keep doing it because stolen energy decays quickly and it's not generative. Sort of the notion is that blood that vampires take in doesn't fill them up. It just kind of helps them hang on, but it doesn't, you know, go on to create more energy for them. So they have to keep feeding. They're compulsive.
It's kind of like a meal then. They need to just have a meal every now and then to keep their energy supplies up.
Right. A meal of a certain kind, because it's not really what a being is designed to feed on. I mean, one of the interesting parts of the myth is that vampires are supposed to be able to live forever. So immortality, perfection, in many of the myths they are trying to achieve not just survival, immortal survival, but also perfection is their goal. So they'd never settle for mere humanity. They must be superhuman. And that's why some people, and I think maybe this is something that you've addressed in your work, have talked about narcissism, particularly what a psychologist would call malignant narcissism, as being the clinical term that one could use to describe a certain kind of vampirism.
Mm-hmm.
One kind of vampirism. But it's not the only one, because people can also be vampiric from a point of powerlessness. So, for example, in Asia, so in our culture, for example, the predominant myth at this point is Dracula. So a powerful warlord, and he seduces people with his powerfulness, and then because they want to be near his powerfulness, his, you know, his money, his influence, his wittiness or whatever, they give over their blood. That is what I, in the book, call the masculine form of vampirism, which a woman could use, too, absolutely.
Right, yeah.
In Asia, their vampire is a pitiful creature. They have a vampire who's a sweet mist by the side of the road, and people enter the mist wanting to somehow help it or rescue it or commune with it in its all its sweet, lovely softness, and rather like the spider's web covered with dewdrops, it seems very beautiful and soft and vulnerable, but once you're in it, you can't get out of it. And that that form of vampirism is what I talk about as a feminine form, which men can also use. It's just because our culture thinks of women as using the power of weakness and men as using the power of dominance. But there are many.
And yet now in our culture we see so much of the masculine weakness too, the men coming across as victims who have been so abused by their ex-wives and
right.
situations like that.
Right. So it wouldn't matter whether you're male or female. If you are stealing energy under the guise of weakness, that's one way of doing it. If you're stealing it under the guise of strength, that's another way of going about it. But in the end, the gain is almost always, and it isn't conscious gain, you understand. Vampires operate in the night, which for a Jungian means in the unconscious. So few people are running around saying, oh, I'm going to steal somebody else's energy. No. So this is just something that this is the only way they've known, or they don't know when it comes over them. You know, they might be pretty vampiric, like a man might be very vampiric with women but not with other men, or with a certain kind of woman, for example. So it's something that ignites or switches on, and then they have that kind of relationship for, you know, reasons that are particular to their life experience. But the game is always that they are seeming to offer something in exchange for life force, but what they offer is usually empty or even a lie, and that the exchange is not equal.
And isn't that normally because they come from a place of spiritual depletion? I mean, they don't have any, and when I say spiritual depletion, I talk about, we tend to get our energy from more of a divine source, draw it from life itself. And it seems like, from what I've seen, a lot of psychic vampires don't have this ability to really draw nourishment from life.
That's an interesting, you know, this may be, maybe it's a time to just speak to a few words, which is something about, so from my frame of reference, there are three realms. This would be a very Jungian way of approaching it. There is the realm of matter, which is what it appears to be, instinct, solidity, the isness of things. There is the realm of spirit, which is ideas and the energetics of notions, the infinite, the immortal. And then there is the place where those two realms touch each other, where they, Jung said, they both meet and do not meet, which is the realm of soul. So that is spirit in matter, inspired matter, materialized spirit. And I would say, actually, that, I mean, this is, I didn't say this in the book, but from my point of view, that people in whom the vampire is operating either over-concretize, so they're accumulating things that do not have meaning, or they're in the realm of spirit, but they're not embodying it. You know, there are plenty of vampires, for example, in the realms of the ministry or psychology, let me just say, my own benighted field. And they are very focused on one end, let's say, and they're very focused on spirituality, but they're not really paying attention to what's happening in the isness of the world, in the concrete, literal impact that they're having. So those two realms of spirit and matter are disconnected, they're dissociated. And that, I would say, actually, is where a lot of vampirism occurs, personally.
That's really profound. So you say that we not only confront this archetype in others, but also in ourselves, and that nobody is really conscious. We're not conscious of that vampiric energy within ourselves. How would we recognize it?
Answering a slightly different question, and then I'll move to the other one. Do we know when we have been vampirized?
Okay.
Almost always, we feel less than. Now, it could be that the initial vampire was somebody we knew in our childhood, so it's an old voice that lives in us that's saying, you're not pretty, you're not smart, you're not good enough, you can't. So the feeling of less than is almost always a sign that we have been taken from somewhere. And then the other sign is a yearning for an indescribable more. There's never enough money, admiration, food, alcohol, whatever. A lot of addiction would be tied into this. Some people might say that addiction is a way to direct that desire for feeding onto something that's not human, in the case of substance addiction, that you just are trying to fill a hole that cannot be filled by whatever it is you're using, food, alcohol, some kind of behavior, gambling or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
So those are all signs that we have somehow our bucket has been drained down into the too low category. And that's why the book's name is Unholy Hungers, because it is a hunger for something, but it's unholy in the sense that it wasn't just the normal ebb and flow of energy that we can then replenish by doing something healthy and generative. We're trying to get it, you know, scramble for just anything that might just fill that void, like eating candy, when really what you need is protein. In terms of how we know that we are being vampiric, it's a bit of the same thing. When we find ourselves nourishing ourselves on things that we are beginning to suspect are actually not nourishing at all, that's almost surely a sign that that thing has then activated in us. And that would be staying in relationships in which we are not really being nourished, as well as eating things that don't nourish us, or doing things to excess because we feel so uncomfortable when we're not filling ourselves up with whatever that thing is. So those are two signs. And, you know, that then the metaphor is that's when the light is dawning, and that the minute that we can look at a behavior like that, then the vampiric relationship, either with us as vampire or as the victim, is beginning to die, as we know from the movies, you know, how they sort of fritter away in the light. Also, you know, vampires can't see their own reflections, so anytime we can see some element of ourselves that might be vampiric, then that also means that it's becoming less so simply in the recognition of it.
So we're more likely to be coming out of that when we recognize it, because we're becoming more self-aware.
Yes, I would say so. And recognizing, you know, all of this is metaphor, another piece of the myth is that vampires can't see their shadows, they cast no shadow. And from a Jungian perspective, particularly in therapy, to look at one's shadow, to be able to see one's shadow side, that is the side that one does not recognize in oneself, which can have some good things in it too, would be another sign that you're less likely to be operating in the blind, compulsive, nighttime realm of the vampire. And the Jungian notion is that shadow is not inherently bad. It is good instinct gone astray or locked in a closet and made feral, and that when you start to give it attention and air it out a little bit and find productive ways to run the energy, then it stops being dangerous. So that would be another way of kind of redeeming one's own vampire.
Or when you bring it into the light, it ceases
mm-hmm.
to be a shadow.
Yeah, right.
Another interesting thing that I find about the vampire myth, which, you know, I know a little bit from watching old movies and things, but what I remember is once one gets bitten, they become the vampire.
Yeah.
And it seems to really relate a lot. Now, a lot of my clients who have had partners who have malignant narcissism
mm-hmm.
and are trying to get away from that, one of the most common questions I get is, how do I know that I'm not the narcissist? Because as they begin to delve into the study and try to understand it, they start to see a lot of these qualities within themselves. And also because they've been depleted so much from someone who has been, you know, taking their energy, they get into this point of powerlessness where they are reaching out and trying to get that energy back.
Right. That would be an exact, I mean, one very good interpretation of the metaphor that when you are bitten, then you become. And the vampire myth offers remedies for vampirism, a variety of remedies. And those are, if you were going to continue, let's say, working with a client and you wanted to work with this metaphor, you would be turning to those. One of those is decapitation. So the more we stay in our heads and out of our bodies, the more likely we are to be able to stay or keep our, you know, mostly stay in our heads, I would guess, or keep that dissociation going, the more likely we are to be vampiric. But when we start to really inhabit our bodies with our consciousness and get to the body memory of where some of this hunger of whatever flavor it is has come from, then that's a way to help us back to our true good instincts for what really nourishes us. Because there is a time to look at the problem, to say I'm in a vampiric relationship or whatever it is, and then there's a time to say, okay, I acknowledge that. Now I'm going to look for something healthy that feeds me in a way that this relationship never did and really is sustaining and healthy. A similar thing is that you drive a stake through their heart of living wood. You bring life in, and that's also, I think, another metaphor for really going to the heart and the feeling of things. And our mortality and our natural decay, and what do you want to do with your life, with your one wild and precious life, as the poet Mary Oliver would say. What is it you plan to do with yourself? And not looking for a relationship to keep you immortal forever. I mean, it's a lovely thing. You know, of course we want to be in that transcendent, immortal place of love. But if we don't make our peace with our own mortal bodies, then we are very likely to start feeding on other people.
Wow. Yeah, you're presenting some new ideas to me, and looking at the mythology behind this energy we call psychic vampirism.
Mm-hmm.
It's really profound when you look at things like driving the stake through the heart and cutting off the head as having symbolic meaning. Because I don't think a lot of us look at it that way.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, we are a very literal culture.
Mm-hmm.
We have our myths, certainly. Look at our movies, my goodness. But and then we have the concrete world. But we are not in the habit of building the bridge between them, you know. And so we watch, you know, marvel at Heath Ledger's Joker, right? The instant
mm-hmm.
chaos. But we are not so inclined to say, in what way is he describing an energy that is in all of us, in all of our lives? He's a metaphor for something. And that bridge between the literal, like a literal vampire, and the literal experience of having somebody steal your energy, and then notion of vampire, to build that bridge is not something that we spend a lot of time doing in this very scientific, increasingly scientific and technological culture. We do ourselves great disservice when we cut the arts out of our education. But that's
right, right, absolutely.
That's where we would get to it probably.
So what do you recommend that someone do when they realize that they're in a relationship with a vampiric energy?
Mm-hmm. That would depend very much on the specifics of the relationship. Certainly recognizing that kind of energy pattern is happening is very important. Consciousness brings the light of day on
mm-hmm.
this. And so recognition is nine-tenths of the battle in certain cases. Usually it is not a good idea to directly confront a vampire. I mean, in myth. Usually vampires don't like it when they are denied, or, and, you know, sort of like your experience with your ex-boyfriend or your boyfriend breaking into the room. They are panicking, basically, because it's like an animal. It's a very primitive energy, and so you take a hungry dog's food away from it, it's likely to attack. And so to simply say to somebody, I think you're a vampire and I'm not going to let you feed on me anymore, is probably not going to be very successful.
Right.
Things are not likely to go well in that conversation.
Mm-hmm.
From my point of view, and this, I didn't say this again so much in the book, so explicitly, but I think that as your clients described, when somebody gets into relationship with a person who's vampiric, who is basically seeking a power-based relationship and trying to develop that with them, then they themselves start operating on the power ethic. And one of the, you know, it's always very much harder to change other people than to change oneself. And one of the best ways to stop that power exchange is to find one's own source of healthy energy, independent from the relationship. One of the examples I recently saw in a movie I was watching, a DVD, was the movie about Tina Turner, where Angela Bassett starts, called What's Love Got to Do with It? And, you know, Ike Turner was a very abusive man, a very exploitive, a very vampiric, a good model of a vampire.
Mm-hmm.
And in that movie, one does get the sense, I don't know what Tina Turner would say about this, but they certainly seem to portray it this way, that in a way she was as caught in the game as he. She didn't start it, but she was in the position of powerlessness, and then she would use whatever weapons of powerlessness that she had, you know, to have him rescue her or feel sorry for her, and that was the dance back and forth. And the turning point, as I understand it, for Tina Turner came when she discovered Buddhist practice, when she started chanting. And it was not an immediate transformation, like suddenly all her life was better, but that, my understanding of her story, was where she got the strength to tap into a deep resource in herself, in her body, in her spirit, in her soul, that allowed her to stand her ground, not to reengage in the aggression, in the fighting, and all the drama that had been so much a part of their relationship, but to be very clear and rooted and neutral in saying, that's your way, Ike, but it's not my way, and I'm not going to do that anymore. That could be a lot of different things for different people. It could be some form of art. It could be some form of sport. It could be some kind of a learning, somebody learning a new area of mastery that is really meaningful for them. Something that really nourishes their soul so that they have their own, they can let go of the false sense of nourishment, the false food of power, and get back into the true food of love. And that doesn't mean just love for another person, you understand. I mean, Tina Turner, it looks like, found a deep source of love in her Buddhist practice, which I understand she still does to this day. And it could be, you know, watching Michael Phelps swim. I mean, what's more love than that? You know, he's in it, you know. Some of the athletes are very compulsive, but it just looks to me like he's just, you know, he just can't be out of the water, right? So it could be that. It doesn't have to be something exotic, and even doesn't have to be something that's explicitly spiritual, but it has soulfulness for the person. It lights your fire. That's exactly right. It lights your fire in a generative way, in a regenerating kind of way, so that in a centering way, so that when somebody starts to dance the dance of you don't care enough about me, or if you really love me, you do such and such, that you can stand in your own center and say, that is your view. That is not my view. I am where I am. You know, find where you are, because that's not my dance anymore. And then you're much less likely, usually basically what's happening is it's a way of kind of cutting off the blood supply, the vampirized blood supply, and then they're going to go look for somebody else, essentially.
And that's typically what happens, isn't it? Rather than, I understand a lot when we dance differently it forces the dance to change,
right,
which causes them to have to dance differently. Now, what percentage would you say a vampire would actually change, and in a positive way? Would you say that's likely at all?
Well, one way it's not likely is to continue in one's own way, old way of dealing with them, which frequently has to do with berating, shaming, pleading, you know, that the 12-step people would call that the dance of the dependent and the codependent. And
right.
That doesn't end anything. We know that. And
mm-hmm.
you call it whatever you like. So that's not going to work. How often does the centered, rooted, clear, self-nourished voice induce the other person to find their own? I couldn't tell you in percentages. It would certainly depend on the degree to which that vampiric energy was in control of the person, of the other person. And the old notion, another old notion of vampirism, was that it was like an infection, and that it spread like an infection. And we know that infections come in lots of forms. You can have a very pretty severe infection of a finger, but the fingers, on the other hand, aren't infected. So one part of the body can be infected severely or mildly. The whole body can be infected severely or mildly, or any degree in between. And that's kind of the way that what a Jungian would call archetypal energies, in other words, certain flavors of instinct and behavior and thought and feeling, that they run that way. It might, if it's a kind of a mild case, situationally induced vampiric behavior, somebody's out of a job or they're sick or they are going through a grieving process or something, then probably, you know, it's easier to cure a mild infection, a mild infection than a severe one. If, however, the person has what a psychologist would call a character disorder, if they have a very entrenched pattern of feeling and behaving and believing in which love just isn't on their screen for a variety of reasons. They don't know how to get it. They don't know how to generate it. They never had it, or they weren't, their psyches, their bodies were not able to hold on to it for lots of reasons. Then that's going to be tough for them to change. And
so then they're just likely to go somewhere else for food.
Right.
And you know, the interesting phenomenon that I run into with the victims, or I don't even like to use the word victims, but let's say women or men that are involved with vampiric energies, is once that person goes and finds someone else, which in the narcissistic situation is, most of the time, it happens quite immediately.
Right.
When the woman, and I'm just going to use the woman because that's 90% of my clientele.
Mm-hmm.
When the woman begins to find her power and start standing up for herself and start getting strong, she may immediately notice that this man who has been the love of her life for I don't know how long suddenly disappears and has this new passionate, powerful relationship, or so it appears.
Right.
And it's quite devastating.
Right.
To the woman. Why do you think that it's so devastating to see him find another source of food?
Well, the most obvious answer is because she's attached to him. You know,
mm-hmm.
he is a source of what seems to be love. And we are not always particularly good at distinguishing nourishing love from not-so-nourishing love, from addictive love. I mean, love is many things traveling under the same banner. So whatever she thought she was getting, and here's the tricky thing, is that sometimes we think we're getting something from somebody else. In fact, they are switching on something inside of us I mean, all love is essentially projective, at least in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
And so we think somebody is Prince Charming, and to some degree, Prince Charming is present because we think he is. And then we discover that that's not really what he is or not fully what he is. Well, depending on how much we believe that Prince Charming was entirely in him, that's going to say something about how disappointed we are. So this is an old reference, but, you know, I love film, and I like to use modern references. There is a film made in the 60s, very popular musical that's coming back on Broadway called The Music Man, about a charlatan who pretends to be a leader of boys bands, and he comes to River City, Iowa, where people are kind of sour, you know, and bored, and, you know, and he ignites the town, convincing them he will give them a boys band. You know, he leads them up and down the streets singing 76 trombones and stuff. Well, he's actually a snake oil salesman. He doesn't know anything about boys bands. And at the end of the show, he's caught. And they expose him. And he's the librarian, the only person who knows anything about music, has fallen in love with him. But she always knows, because she knows the truth, that he really isn't what he pretends to be. And yet the effect he has had on the town is real, and the effect he's had on her. And so when he is exposed, there's a key scene where he leads the little boys who have been just sort of thinking about the minuet and G, and they actually sort of play it. And the notion is that sometimes if you believe in something hard enough, it really is. And certainly his effect on the town really is true, that he has given them a band in theory, you know, in their
right.
dreams. And so she is not so disappointed because she knows that the real gift of him is the magic. Any storyteller or filmmaker knows that. You know, just because there really is no Jedi Knight doesn't mean that George Lucas is a bad man. He gave us Jedi Knights, in theory.
And
so,
Yoda.
And Yoda and Darth Vader and all those great characters. And so somebody, it would be sort of like saying, how could you, you know, lie to me about Yoda? It was like, well, part of it was that you believed in Yoda. I mean, did you notice it was a movie? You know,
mm-hmm.
and so there's a certain degree of, oh, how could you betray me? But, you know, in the end, it was the betrayed's projection to some degree that has been taken away. And how well a person can work with that truth, you know, when they've been betrayed, is a test of the soul, I can tell you from my own experience, and I know others who've done that would say so too. But then to say, okay, but, you know, the projection, the power of Prince Charming or whatever it was, that's real. And that had an effect, and it changed me, and essentially it came from me, you know. So I still have that and always will, and this person ignited it. And good for him, even if he was a, you know, crud in the end. I will always have that.
So the prince type is real. The Prince Charming is really an archetype.
Yes,
in a sense.
Yes, any, you know, a Jungian would say that any image or story that has, particularly that has held a lot of power for a culture, or particularly across cultures and across the ages, those stories are archetypal. By which, my understanding, Jung meant that they correspond to energies that are common to many human beings, and we recognize them, and that's why they have such meaning for us. And that's why some stories have a lot of power and others don't, you know, he would say, because those stories have a lot of archetypal force. They have a lot of metaphorical validity for us, experiential validity.
Now there's a lot of a lot out there on the divine marriage right now.
Oh, yeah.
And that would be the marriage between our inner male and female.
Mm-hmm.
Or our archetypal characters, perhaps.
Yeah, that's
us.
One way of looking at it. Yep. Mm-hmm.
So in order for someone to come to that place of wholeness, wouldn't you say a divine marriage needs to happen on some level, that we need to find our wholeness, that we need to find that masculine part of ourselves if we're feminine, or that feminine part of ourselves if we're masculine, and bring those two forces together mm-hmm. to form a whole.
Yes, I would use, I mean, Jung certainly talked about the divine marriage or the hieros gamos. If I were to encourage people to seek something, it would be a healthy inner marriage.
Mm-hmm.
Divine is always a little tricky, you know.
Yes.
But healthy and inner, that I definitely believe in. And by inner, it would be within oneself. And, you know, it's interesting because when you're talking about, like, let's say a woman being very betrayed by the vampiric man, who the narcissist who goes off to find some other relationship, what frequently I think happens is that, you know, let's say she gets stronger. So she's starting to embody her inner masculine. I mean, not that masculinity is always strong. It's like, let's say, proactive and vulnerable or receiving or something. I hate those. The words are a little biased with this masculine feminine. But so she has been a very receiving, open, responsive person. And now she's getting a bit more proactive and assertive and, you know, lots of other good things. And then he doesn't want that. He wants somebody to be in the weak role. And so he goes and finds somebody who will continue to do that. He wants a split. Again, the splitting is, you know, the root of all evil is truly dissociation. So he gets this split thing where he's going to be strong and she's going to be receptive and weak and accommodating. The same can happen in the other direction where, you know, a man can start to really connect, many men do this midlife, connect with his more feeling, receptive, responsive side. And then the woman is like, well, heck with this. I want a real man, you know. And she goes to look for a real man. And then he's all like, well, wait a minute. You know, what happened? I thought you loved me. And, you know, he has a point. You know, she loved him until he wasn't big, strong, powerful millionaire anymore. And then now she doesn't love him anymore. And so there's another example where the, you know, one person, if you're going to have inner marriage for both people, it's going to happen for both people, because frequently people don't want to be in relationship with somebody who's got a nice inner marriage going, because then all of a sudden they're not, it's not fusional and interdependent anymore.
Right, they're no longer dependent on that person, and,
that's right.
He or she notices that detachment.
Right, and then, you know, what stops happening is there's not control. So back to the power business again.
Mm-hmm.
If you have a division of roles, if one is strong and the other is weak, if one is masculine, the other is feminine, then there's control, right?
Right, right.
Because you need each other. But the minute you stop with that, the minute that one person is self-sufficient, then all of a sudden you don't have that need for the other person. You're not dependent on the other person. Oops! Now you know they can't control you anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's interesting. I work with a lot of my clients on this, but when that other person goes, the vampiric energy goes and finds somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
You can tell the person that was left behind, the person that is getting stronger.
Yeah.
This is a good thing.
Yeah.
This is a good thing, and that person that he is with still hasn't quite learned how to have that strength that you are getting right now.
Mm-hmm.
Because what tends to happen is there's a rejection that happens. I'm not good enough.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right.
And really the truth is that you're good and you're getting better.
Right. Yes, that would be true. But if we all have, you know, to be kind to us all, we all have those inner voices that tell us that we are not good enough and not enough. And back to the vampire thing again, right? We're not enough.
Mm-hmm.
We're less than. And
mm-hmm.
then that starts to play into the whole game all over again.
And what is it that is so seductive about a vampiric energy? I mean, every story, including my own, these men come along, sweep you off your feet.
Yeah.
They're full of charisma. They're full of excitement. They can sell us on anything.
Mm-hmm.
Why do they have such an effect?
Well, I would say, and again, I'm quoting other people here, so now we're kind of getting to Marianne Woodman.
Good.
I mentioned before the show. So Marianne Woodman, mm-hmm. another Jungian analyst. She has done a lot of writing about the body and addiction and really bringing that spirit into matter, creating soulfulness. So her two best-known books, I think, are Addiction to Perfection and The Pregnant Virgin. What she would say is that there is something about a vampire, and I include, you know, these would be the seductive women and the seductive men,
mm-hmm.
in which there is a promise of something transcendent, of something superhuman, superhuman power, sexuality, intimacy, something like that. And that if we join with them, we will transcend our mere mortality. We will leave all that dreck behind. That's the vampire's promise. And live forever. Fly high and live forever. The reality, of course, is not that simple, and the price is extremely high when we believe them, but that's what they're promising. And, gosh, what a hard promise to resist.
My question would be, where does that promise come from within that vampiric energy? Is it because he rejects the mortality within himself?
Yeah, I think that would be a very good guess. Yeah, and for a woman within herself. Yes.
Mm-hmm.
She's going to be more beautiful. He's going to be more potent. You know, they're just going to sail away into some kind of superhuman nirvana and take us with them. Now, how they manage that, you know, where that comes from, we could talk a lot about how that develops in a human being, but if that's a longer conversation. So
mm-hmm.
if you're just willing to say somehow this person has gotten that. I mean, one example is that when somebody, for example, has been the object of a parent's adoration, sometimes not so healthy adoration,
right.
they can come to have a very inflated view of themselves that they then need to keep afloat. One of the great books about narcissism, I'm imagining you may know it, is called The Drama of the Gifted Child by Alice
right.
Miller. And she talks a lot about that there's this kind of seesaw in a narcissist between grandiosity and depression or deflation. And so they do have the capacity for being larger than life. How irresistible. But
mm-hmm.
it takes a lot more than one human being's worth of blood to keep that hot air balloon afloat.
Right. Because these are the people who, if they were indeed praised and admired in an unhealthy way when they were young,
mm-hmm.
they came to see themselves as being more special.
Yes, right. And then I defy anyone to match the power of an idealizing parent. You can't not do that for another adult, you know, adult to adult. You know, you and I can never be the adoring mother that someone had as a child. And no man can never be the adoring father. But if we go about seeking it, you know, if somebody is seeking that, you know, they can adore us and then expect that kind of adoration in return. Well, it looks great for a while. I mean, that's the whole game with, not game, but the whole pattern of new love, right? We just can't believe our good fortune at having found this perfect human being. And it is a miracle that we fall in love with anybody, really. You know, so,
mm-hmm.
but then there's the coming to terms with the mortality part. And so people then fail us. They aren't the adoring parent, or we fail them and we're not the adoring, you know, God. And that's when things start to get ugly.
So we have to find that healthy adoration within ourselves and
mm-hmm.
and finding the healthy is the trick, isn't
mm-hmm.
it?
Yeah. Yeah, a healthy a healthy esteem for ourselves that, you know, gives us a reason to, for our reach to exceed our grasp, you know, and say, well, I don't know, but maybe I can do this. You know, I'm not just nothing. I can do this. And maybe I can even do a little more than I think, you know. Every year, mm-hmm. you know, every Olympics, the Olympians beat the prior world records. They're being broken all the time, you know. The impossible is achieved. So there's nothing wrong with that as long as we've also made peace with our imperfection and our mortality. And that is what the vampire has not done.
That's true, because in these vampiric or narcissistic entities, they cannot see any wrong in themselves. So that wrong is projected outward.
Right. Very good. No shadow, no mirror, no image in the mirror. Right. That's exactly right. Can't die. No corruption. No mortality. Yep.
Well, it's just amazing how the game of life works.
Yes, it is.
It really is. It never ceases to amaze me. And another thing that never ceases to amaze me is, you know, I've been working with narcissism, malignant narcissism, the people that have been affected by it for quite a long time. And then I find all these other terms that fit in, like last show was on gaslighting. And you know, there's all these different, and I'm sure you're familiar with that movie.
Yes, indeed. Yeah, absolutely.
So you know, we've got all these different ways of looking at the same kinds of things.
Mm-hmm. Yes, that's true. I mean, it's kind of the glory of the human species is that we're trying to figure it out, trying to figure out something. I mean, not every one of us, but a lot of people are trying to figure it out. And so, you know, different people have different things to offer. And, you know, Jung had one thing, Freud had another. Artists and filmmakers and all, they have yet another. And yet, you know, it does sometimes converge in the most wonderful way.
It does.
Mm-hmm.
Well, can you tell me, Barbara, a little bit? We've got about 6 minutes left, and I want you to talk just a little bit about what the theater of the soul is. I find that intriguing, and I'd just like you to talk just a little bit about that.
Mm-hmm. Basically, it kind of goes back to what I was saying about spirit, matter, and soul. So it's a workshop for women in which the exercises, little gentle exercises, and not like self-sharing of stories, but just working with imagery, dreams, art, voice, movement, are designed to start facilitating the communication between the images that are ours, that come to us in dreams or movies or books or something, and then the symptoms that we have in our bodies and the things that are happening in our lives. This is, again, based on the work of Marianne Woodman primarily and modeled quite a bit after the workshops that she does, that she describes in The Pregnant Virgin. And the goal is to help the participants work with their own imagery from their dreams and see how that corresponds to the symptoms in their bodies, the events of their lives, the feelings in their hearts, and facilitate that dialogue. So that's basically what the goal of the workshop is.
And is that a workshop where people come to a certain area to participate in it?
Yes, and we usually have not done them a lot. It's kind of a labor of love, actually, because it takes three facilitators, and there are only 24 spaces in each workshop. If people are interested in learning more about it, they can go to our website, which is www.theater, spelled the American way, E-R, Theater of the Soul, theater-of-the-soul.com. So Theater of the Soul with dashes.com. And that's where descriptions of the facilitators and description about what we do and when our workshops are offered is listed there.
Great. And where can people go to get your book?
They can get anywhere. Amazon.com. Anywhere.
Okay.
I mean, I love little bookstores that, you know, have used books, and I'm happy to buy it. Any way people want to buy it is fine with me, but they can just go straight over to good old Amazon and get it from them.
And actually, you can go to my website, www.narcissismfree.com, because I have a link to your book on Amazon.
Oh, great. Perfect.
So that's a simple way, too.
Absolutely.
So I want... I want to really thank you for joining us and sharing your incredible insights.
Thanks,
really.
Thanks
really
for giving
enjoyed.
Me the opportunity. Thank you for that.
Yeah, it's been absolutely wonderful. And I do recommend to our audience that you do check out the Unholy Hungers book and learn as much as you can, because as I always say, education is power. The more you know, the more that you can empower yourself and be all that you're meant to be. And I just love the idea of really finding what lights your fire, what you're passionate about, what you can get excited about, that is something that's for you.
Yes.
I know for me it's my music. My music is one of my passions, and it is one thing that has always taken me out of negative situations. It's always given me an outlet. That's given me a voice. Mm-hmm. It's given me a sense of myself.
Mm-hmm. Good for you.
Yeah.
Good for you. May each listener find that thing for themselves. Really.
Absolutely.
Is that such a key to really fulfillment, happiness? Absolutely.
Well, thanks again, Barbara.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
And I wanted to just mention briefly that we have another show coming up in September. We've got one coming up in a couple weeks that is unconfirmed yet. My show is every other Tuesday evening at 7 o'clock. On the 2nd of September, we have Is There a Cure for Narcissistic Personality Disorder with Kim and Steve Cooper. So please join us for that. And have a wonderful day. I'm going to end with one of my songs called Come Out of Yourself. We'll see you next time.